Again, From Farewell America, ostensibly authored by James Hepburn, actually authored by the French intelligence service, STECE. Galen, who had conceived the idea of the Vlasov Army, Russian anti-communist troops, was given the responsibility for the underground that continued to operate behind communist lines until 1950. In Poland, Galen's guerrillas on March 28, 1947, murdered General Karol Swierczynski, Swierczynski, Vice Minister of Defense, who, under the name of Walter, had commanded the 14th International Brigade in Spain, and who served as the model for one of the characters in Hemingway's For Whom the Bell Tolls. Okay, so next time you see Gary Cooper and Ingrid Bergman in that famous major motion picture version of For Whom the Bell Tolls, and you see Gary Cooper shooting and spitting his defiance at the fascists at the end, keep in mind that Galen dispatched one of the members of their group in actual combat, not on the movie screen, during this guerrilla warfare we're talking about in Eastern Europe. A couple of other things concerning that guerrilla warfare. Now, I'm going to, last two quotes I'm going to read you here concerning that guerrilla warfare come from a book called The Borman Brotherhood. The Borman Brotherhood was authored by another former British intelligence agent named William Stevenson, last name S-T-E-V-E-N-S-O-N. Now, this William Stevenson is not to be confused with another British intelligence agent named William Stevenson, who's S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S-O-N. That William Stevenson was known as Intrepid. He was in charge of all British intelligence in the Americas during World War II. This is a different William Stevenson, who also writes about World War II intelligence. He wrote about the Third Reich and also was a British intelligence agent. Different spelling. Now, William Stevenson's The Borman Brotherhood was published in hardcover by Harcourt Brace Jovanovich in 1973 and in softcover by Bantam Books in 1974. Now, I'd like to read you an interesting detail here from the softcover Bantam edition of William Stevenson's The Borman Brotherhood. Now, recall that one of the guerrilla groups that Niptuck was reading you about that Galen set up to harass the Red Army in its rear and which carried on this guerrilla warfare is also was alluded to in that passage quoted from a Polish military writer. One of these guerrilla groups was called the Werewolves. Now, the Werewolves were comprised primarily of Hitler youth. Now, the interesting thing is that the Werewolves had an interesting battle cry which was broadcast by Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry during the closing days of the Third Reich. And it's a battle cry that will be pretty familiar to the bunch of you, I think. Of the battle cry of the werewolf guerrillas who were set up by Galen and carried on guerrilla warfare in Eastern Europe after World War II. Officials who helped the enemy had to be publicly punished. It was the symbolism, as always, that counted. Radio Werewolf hammered the theme, better dead than red, a phrase that lived long after. Bolshevism was the real enemy. The Nazis had always resisted the Bolsheviks. Therefore, any German who helped the enemies of Nazism was helping the Bolsheviks and was a traitor. A climate was being created that would favor the concealment of wanted men. So again, the cry of Radio Werewolf, their battle cry, better dead than red. And that is where the phrase better dead than red comes from. And of course, that is one of the mainstays of sort of rabid that phrase is one of the watchwords of rabid anti-communism today. Now, interestingly enough, the closing days of the Third Reich also saw the concoction, the genesis of the phrase Iron Curtain. Now, most people believe that Winston Churchill concocted the phrase Iron Curtain. Churchill publicized the phrase Iron Curtain, but in point of fact, he actually borrowed it from a man named Count Lutz Schwerin von Krosigk, last name K-R-O-S-I-G-K. Now, von Krosigk was Hitler's last finance minister, succeeding Hjalmar Schacht, and in a propaganda broadcast during the closing days of the Third Reich, Count Schwerin von Krosigk coined the phrase Iron Curtain. Winston Churchill borrowed it from him. Reading once again from The Borman Brotherhood by William Stevenson. The threat of war between the Western Allies and Russia had been promoted for years by the Nazis. Their vision of ultimate conflict with, quote, barbaric Bolshevism, unquote, produced the first reference to an Iron Curtain. It was uttered by Hitler's former finance minister, Count Schwerin von Krosigk, on May 2, 1945, when he was desperately trying to win Allied recognition for the government of Admiral Dönitz. Schwerin von Krosigk was an unctuous figure who had never forgotten Hesse's saying before his departure that the two Germanic nations, Britain and Germany, were fighting each other to the enormous satisfaction of the Bolsheviks. The Count, a former Rhodes scholar who seems to have learned nothing about the English during his time at Oxford, calculated that Hesse had made some impression on his British hosts. "The Iron Curtain moves closer," he declared in a broadcast. "People caught in the mighty hands of the Bolsheviks are being destroyed," unquote. The term was picked up from the German broadcast. Churchill used it when he cabled President Harry Truman on May 12th. That's 10 days after von Krosigk used it in the broadcast. Quote, "An iron curtain is drawn upon their front. We do not know what is going on behind," unquote. A year later, he dropped it into a speech in the United States. It demonstrates the infectious nature of the fears deliberately released by Hitler's followers in order to win Western sympathy. And so the phrases, "better dead than red" and "iron curtain" have their genitor in the closing days of the Third Reich. Worth noting in passing that the phrase "guns versus butter" was coined by Hermann Goering, the Reichsmarshal, when he said Germany needs guns, not butter. All of which, I guess, is to say that these phrases, "better dead than red," "iron curtain," "guns versus butter," are being kicked around quite a bit these days. When you hear them, remember where they come from, because the lexicon of 20th century American anti-communism is the lexicon of the Third Reich.
That's right, not only in words, but in deeds also.
That was a section from Radio Free America program number 1, looking back from 1984, the hidden history of the Cold War, part 1. And the main elements there to understand is the use of the OUN, which is closely allied with the UPA. It's used first by the Third Reich and then later by the CIA under the Office of Policy Coordination and Frank Wisner to foment guerrilla warfare behind the Soviet lines, first during World War II and then all the way up on through the early 1950s. It's worth noting that guerrilla warfare went on in the Ukraine and the Baltic republics and parts of Poland. Those are major areas of Soviet ethnic dissidents today. And as we looked at first in the article about Lithuanian fascism being projected by the National Endowment for Democracy through Lithuanian Catholic Religious Aid and the Lithuanian Information Center. And then as we looked at in connection with the Free Congress Foundation, elements of which are closely allied with the OUN, similar activities are going on today, although at least to date overt violence has yet to take place. The elements, though, were the same, and my hypothesis has been is that one of the intentions, the goal basically is either to break the Soviet Union up into its constituent republics, which would then be utilized by the multinational corporations for their own ends, or else to provoke a return to the Cold War by utilizing some of these same elements to produce a militant reaction by Soviet hardliners, something which I think at least to a certain extent is predictable if elements like the OUN, Sejudis, and others are allowed to run free and continue to receive the support they have from the United States. Sooner or later, the KGB and the Soviet military are going to respond to those elements which obviously represent salt in the wounds to a nation which suffered so heavily during the Second World War. It's worth noting, too, that the OUN is very closely allied with an organization called the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN, and that's an organization that we're going to take a look at in the next tape segment that we're going to be looking at, coming from Radio Free America 14. Before that, though, I want to review once again a section of the Free Congress Foundation Goes East, the article from which we reviewed a section a short time ago, and most of which we read into the archives in the third installment of Radio Free America 13. That I put into the archives last week. Now, the main element to talk about here is, once again, the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, a key element of which is the OUN that we've already looked at, first in connection with the Free Congress Foundation, and then in connection with the Office of Policy Coordination and the Third Reich. Oh, by the way, a slight correction. I
failed to note that when I did the broadcast at the time. The Reich Sicherheitshauptamt does not mean secret Bureau of Reich Security. It means, Sicherheit means security, not secret. The RSHA literally means High Bureau of Reich Security, not secret. Secret in German is Geheime. That's where the phrase Gestapo or the term Gestapo comes from. Gestapo is a contraction of Geheime Staatspolizei or secret state police. Okay, so Sicherheit means security, not secret. Minor correction there, but the record should go corrected under the circumstances. Now, returning once again to the Free Congress Foundation Goes East, or a section thereof, once again co-authored by Russ Ballant, B-E-L-L-A-N-T, and Lewis Wolf. This once again from Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35. Now, the key person here that we're going to be talking about is a man named Laszlo Pastor, P-L-A-S-Z-L-O, capital P-A-S-Z-T-O-R. He's a Hungarian fascist who was very closely allied with the ABN, one of the main organizations of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, is the aforementioned OUN. It should be noted that in the Third Reich, or in the Axis nations, in addition to the Third Reich and Japan and Mussolini, Italy rather, under Mussolini, there were also Hungary and Bulgaria and Romania. All of those countries fought for the Axis and against the USSR and the United States during the Second World War. Laszlo Pastor was a member of the Arrow Cross, the key Hungarian fascist organization which led Hungary into the Second World War on behalf of the Axis. Reading now about the connections between Laszlo Pastor and the Free Congress Foundation, and we should bear in mind that Laszlo Pastor is closely allied with the ABN. Finally, FCF's insinuation into the politics of the East must be judged by their selection of Laszlo Pastor to head their Liberation Support Alliance, quote, which seeks to liberate peoples in Central and Eastern European nations. Pastor's involvement in East European politics began in World War II when he joined the youth organization of the Arrow Cross, the Nazi Party of Hungary. When the Arrow Cross was installed in power by a German commando operation, Pastor was sent to Berlin to help facilitate the liaison between the Arrow Cross and Hitler. Pastor was tried and served 2 years in jail for his Arrow Cross activities after an anti-communist government was elected in Hungary in 1945. He eventually came to the U.S. and established the ethnic arm of the Republican National Committee for Richard Nixon. He brought other Nazi collaborators from the Eastern Front into the GOP. Some were later found to have participated in mass murder during the war. The dormant Arrow Cross has surfaced again in Hungary, where there have been attempts to lift the ban on the Nazi organization. Pastor spent several months in Hungary. When Weyrich later conducted training there, he was provided a list of Pastor's contacts inside the country. Weyrich reports that he conducted training for the recently formed and now governing party, New Democratic Forum. Pastor claims to have assisted some of his friends in Hungary in getting NED funding through his advisory position with NED. In 1989, he spoke at the Heritage Foundation under the sponsorship of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, or ABN, a multinational umbrella organization of emigre fascists and Nazis founded in alliance with Hitler in 1943. It is led by the OUN. Pastor spoke for the Hungarian organization, quote-unquote, of ABN, which is the Arrow Cross. Note here the element of historical continuity vis-a-vis the ABN, beginning with Adolf Hitler in 1943 and going all the way up through active participation not only in the U.S. national security establishment, but also the Republican Party. And by the way, we talked about the ABN in addition to Radio Free America 14, part of which we're going to hear now, and part of Radio Free America 15. We also came back to it in the miscellaneous archive show, Nazis and Anti-Semites on George Bush's campaign. We also featured a section of that in another miscellaneous archive show called The Political Resume of George Bush. Now, it's worth noting that the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations has long maintained that the, quote, rollback of communism, which has been advocated by the Western nations and also by our national security establishment, should not just include the ousting of the Soviets from the Eastern European countries, which has now happened under Gorbachev and Glasnost/Perestroika, but beyond that, They advocated that rollback actually involved the breakup of the Soviet Union into its constituent republics and different nationalities. The further rollback, the accelerated rollback advocated by ABN, appears to be one of the two alternative goals of what I see as the ongoing destabilization of the Soviet Union. It seems to me that, and I have hypothesized in this Radio Free America broadcast, in this series I'm doing, that our national security establishment either aims at breaking up the Soviet Union into its constituent republics, the goal of the ABN, or else provoking a return to the Cold War, which would be not only an excuse for our military and related industries to keep raking in the billions they raked in under the Reagan and Bush administrations, but it also would serve as a vehicle for the further destabilization of the Soviet Union by placing further strain on the already badly shaken Soviet economy that in turn would lead to further social dislocation. I believe that either one or the other is the goal of our national security establishment and the ongoing destabilization of the Soviet Union. Now, what we're going to do now is take a look at a section from Radio Free America 14. This is the first Radio Free America show in a two-part Radio Free America series dealing with what was then known as the World Anti-Communist League. This program was originally aired in January of 1986, a little over 5 years ago, and what we're going to be hearing about specifically is the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, a key element of which is the OUN, and it should also be noted that the anti-Bolshevik bloc of Nations is an organization which is carrying on an old policy which predates the Second World War. We're going to begin by looking at an organization called the Prometheus Organization, which could be conceived of as a pre-Wackel-Wackel, and their attempts to foment not only Turkish nationalism inside the Soviet Union, but also the Ukrainian nationalism as well. After taking a look at the Prometheus Organization, we're going to take a look at the OUN and its participation in the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and its work for the Third Reich during the Second World War, a section of which we already looked at in Radio Free America number 1. By the way, speaking of the OUN, recall too that Vilnius in Lithuania, and Lithuania as a whole under Sąjūdis, the organization with many fascist antecedents and participants, that has become the headquarters for activism by dissident Soviet nationalities on the back of Covert Action Information Bulletin, issue number 35, in the first installment of Radio Free America 36, this series I'm doing, we took a look at a picture that is on the back of RFA, of Covert Action Information Bulletin number 35. And there is a picture, and the caption is, "Members of the Ukrainian Nationalist Organization arrive in Vilnius, Lithuania, to voice their support for independence March 23rd. Of 1990, so Lithuania apparently is serving as an epicenter for dissident Soviet nationalities, their connections with Western intelligence, and their fascist antecedents as well. We're now going to hear about more of the ongoing policy, and it predates World War II, to break up the Soviet Union into its constituent nationalities. Once again, this is a section from Radio Free America program number 14. This was originally broadcast in January of 1986. Now, for the rest of the broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at the European and Eurasian branch of Wackel, and specifically, we're going to be taking a look at the anti-Bolshevik nations, the ABN. Now, in a nutshell, the Soviet Union is descended from the old Russian Empire. Basically, the Tsar conquered a bunch of different territories, and when the members, when the subjects of the Russian Empire revolted, what we wound up with, or what the world wound up with, basically was a headless empire, a bunch of states which had been joined artificially through military conquest, and which then found themselves in a sort of a spontaneous political union. And obviously many of the member peoples had nationalistic aspirations of their own. The Ukrainians, many Asian, Middle Eastern peoples in not only the Asian part of the Soviet Union, but also those parts of it that could be considered Eurasian or Middle Eastern. Many of the peoples in the Soviet Union are of Turkic extraction and are very similar to the kinds of ethnic peoples found in the Middle East. We're going to be taking a look at some of the Ukrainians and Ukrainian nationalism, some of the pan-Turkists and some of the Turkic-speaking peoples in the Soviet Union, and how these groups come together in the anti-Bolshevik nations, the ABN. The key name there is Lev Dobryansky, Ronald Reagan's ambassador to the Bahamas.
Now, by way of introducing the anti-Bolshevik nations, which is going to occupy the rest of the broadcast this evening, we're going to read from a superb manuscript, unpublished, unfortunately, called The Dallas Conspiracy. The Dallas Conspiracy was authored by Peter Dale Scott, who's a professor at the University of California at Berkeley, an unpublished manuscript which is available from Tom Davis Books. We'll give you that address at the end of the program. About the ABN, Peter Dale Scott writes as follows in The Dallas Conspiracy. The anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, or ABN, with its American lobby, the AFABN, the American Friends of the Anti-Bolshevik Nations, was similar to, but slightly to the right of, the CIA-supported Assembly of Captive European Nations, or ACEN, with its U.S. CIA front, the American Friends of the Captive Nations, headed by Christopher Emmett. Whereas the ACEN lobbied for the liberation of Poland, Czechoslovakia, and the rest of the area between the Iron Curtain and the USSR, the ABN looked also for the liberation of the Ukraine, Armenia, Georgia, Kosakia, Azerbaijan, Idel-Ural, Turkestan, and of other ethnic nationalities inside the 1939 borders of the Soviet Union. And again, the Soviet Union is an amalgam of a wide variety of different peoples, many of whom had independent nationalistic aspirations. These sometimes merged with a doctrinaire anti-communism and became fascism. It's sort of a mixed bag, and however, after the war, this mixed bag became, and during the war and after the war, World War II, that is, this mixed bag became essentially fascist. Continuing with Scott's narrative, at the heart of the ABN alliance were the resources of two actual post-war underground movements, the Hungarian Freedom Fighters and the Ukrainian OUNR Underground Army. We're interrupting briefly. Recall that Hungary fought on the side of the Axis in World War II as well. Continuing. By 1960, however, the ABN had come to concentrate on psychological and political warfare. Thus, it competed with Russian emigre organizations such as the NTS, or Solidarists, to be discussed shortly, for places in U.S.-supported Psy-War activities like Radio Liberation, later renamed Radio Liberty, in Munich. Recall, that's a Galen operation, and interjecting very briefly here, the Ukrainian nationalists and the ABN in general are inseparable from the Galen organization. They are a major element of it, and simply can't be separated at any point from the Galen organization. Referring to ABN and Radio Liberty, it also participated in planning for a grand world alliance of world anti-communist forces to be called the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation, or WACCFL, whose composition is indicated by the 15-man steering committee elected at a preparatory conference in Mexico City in March of 1958. Recall, we read some of that list in the beginning of the broadcast. The Mexico City Conference was itself called in response to the Taipei Statement of an international group meeting in October of 1957 in Taiwan. Chiang Kai-shek of Taiwan, Syngman Rhee of South Korea, and Diem of South Vietnam were each represented in this steering committee by a top figure in their respective party apparatus. German veterans of Hitler's frustrated anti-Comintern and Ostpolitik programs were included, notably Fritz Kramer, spelled C-R-A-M-E-R, of the CIAS, Committee for Information and Social Activity, a former officer of the Abwehr, that's German military intelligence, in Riga and Lisbon from 1939 to 45. Alfred Gielen, spelled G-I-E-L-E-N, CIAS Secretary General and former Nazi publicist for Goebbels' anti-Comintern, became the WACCFL Steering Committee's Regional Secretary for Europe. And interestingly enough, in a footnote to the passage I just read you, Peter Dale Scott adds about Fritz Kramer, spelled C-R-A-M-E-R, in the 1950s, Kramer was also president of Eberhard Taubert's Volksbund für Frieden und Freiheit, or VFF, an industry-financed private vigilante group to ferret out and maintain files on German leftists. Now, of course, that's very similar to the American Security Council, so it's interesting that a key member of the WACCFL, the steering committee which was to give birth, I guess, act as the midwife for Wackel in 1966, Fritz Kramer, C-R-A-M-E-R, former Nazi intelligence officer, ran just such an organization in combination with a man named Eberhard Taubert. Okay, so a similar kind of organization to the American Security Council. And interestingly enough, Taubert, the man he worked with here, is also interesting. Taubert, the head of, and again, returning to the footnote here, Taubert, the head of Division Pro 2 in Goebbels' propaganda ministry, had, quote, prided himself on being the wire puller behind the anti-Comintern propaganda organization. That from Kurt Tauber's Beyond Eagle and Swastika, Middletown, Connecticut, Wesleyan University Press, 67. So, interestingly enough, now, again, Fritz Kramer, a member of the WACCFL steering committee, key WACL member here, not only a former Nazi intelligencer, but a
co-head of a private intelligence group, which basically provided industry with files on political activists. Also worth noting that the person Eberhard Taubert, who was co-head of this VFF group with Fritz Kramer, was a former participant in Goebbels' propaganda ministry in the anti-Comintern effort. Significant because the American Security Council, similar to function to VFF, also, of course, through the Jung Organization, had links with Goebbels' anti-Comintern effort. Again, looking at Wackel as the second anti-Comintern. Continuing here with Peter Dale Scott's account. The American representatives were veteran China lobbyist Charles Edison of the John Birch Society and American Security Council, and Lev Dobryansky, a Ukrainian-American Army Reserve officer and professor at Georgetown University with close links to Army intelligence circles. The ABN had two of the 15 seats on the World Committee, one less than Latin America. Its representatives were Yaroslav Stetsko, S-T-E-T-Z-K-O, briefly a premier of the short-lived Ukrainian Republic at the time of the 1941 German invasion, and Ferenc Farkas, F-A-R-K-A-S, the ABN military chief, who commanded the Army of Arrow Cross chief Ferenc Salazi, executed as a war criminal, against the Russians in World War II. So, again, the explicitly fascist and pro-Third Reich orientation of many of the component members of ABN has been touched on here, and we're going to develop here as we go.
Okay, and we've got coming up here some other stuff we're going to be getting into, some other remnants and some other parts of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, but again, we have to stress that the makeup of the group and the fact that basically nothing has changed, they've only become more respectable because their leaders are now connected to our current administration. And we've been focusing on some of the Bolshevist groups, the anti-Bolshevist groups from Eastern Europe specifically, and we're going to be probably talking about them more before the broadcast ends. We're coming up on some things having to do with the Middle East, but before we get to that, we have to talk about some of the situations that perhaps even going back a little further than we've been going in the show, talk about some of the situations that led to this particular formation, actually even back before the 30s and before the Nazis came to power, and clear back to the early days of the struggle between Russia, the early Soviet Socialist Republic, and Poland.
Okay, now one of the things to remember about Poland, in fact about all political movements, is that they're not homogeneous. Poland was basically a fascist country, even though it was conquered by Nazi Germany and perhaps suffered worse than any other nation, with perhaps the exception of USSR, under Nazi rule. The Poles were just devastated by the 6 years of Nazi rule, or 5 years of Nazi rule. However, it's important to remember that that Poland, under Marshal Pilsudski, was, for all intents and purposes, a fascist country. It was explicitly anti-labor and anti-Semitic and anti-Soviet, very imperialistic in its aspirations. And however, Pilsudski simply, the Poles were extremely nationalistic, still are, but in that period, whereas Poland had been a major power in previous centuries, because Poland had been a major power in previous centuries, there was a sort of nostalgia on the part of many Polish leaders for a return to a large imperial Poland. Marshal Pilsudski shared these aspirations, and because of this was unable to fit into the sort of fascist coalition that Mussolini and also Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria were able to fit into.
Again, a couple of things, Mussolini being a good example. This was, of course, much the same reason that Mussolini was able to bring the people of Italy behind fascism, was because of the fact that it had been so long since Italy had been a major player. In fact, in the case of Italy, it had been roughly 2,000 years since Italy had been any kind of force on the world political scene. And Mussolini was able to inspire his countrymen with the memories of the legions of Rome and the days that the world quaked to the boots or the sandals of the legions of Rome, or whatever his phrase was that he used, and was able to inspire, just as, again, we mentioned Yoshio Kodama and his idea about combining militarism and nationalism with this sort of samurai ideal of medieval Japan. We notice these things happening very often, these kinds of emotional appeals to a nationalism that is, in many cases, not only ridiculously unpractical, but several thousand years out of date. So this is how Pilsudski was able to appeal to the Polish people and was able to, among other things, to romanticize what was basically, as Dave put it, a fascist country. Again, the other point that needs to be stressed for people who are not familiar with history and have had their fascism and their capitalism and communism packaged for them in TV movies and things, as Dave said, there were numerous people in Germany who were anti-Hitler and were still pro-Nazi. In the same way, the fascists of Poland, especially by the end of the war, were distinctly anti-Nazi, most of them, while nonetheless giving up none of their own pro-fascist mentality. So that's a keen and key important point to remember, that because you are anti-Nazi, you are not necessarily anti-fascist and vice versa.
Also recall that in Radio Free America number one, we talked about Polish attempts to reobtain parts of the Ukraine. So Polish nationalism and the resulting conflicts with the Soviet Union is something that we've touched on in the past and that has been going on for a long time. Again, Herbert Hoover's efforts aiding the Russo-Polish War of 1921, we talked about in Radio Free America number one. Okay, now, touching back on a comment that Nip Tuck made, one of the groups which, one of the peoples in the 20th century who have been affected by an irredentist movement, so to speak, by basically a longing for bygone days of empire, are the Turks. Of course, the Ottoman Turks built a very, very powerful empire encompassing much of Europe during the Middle Ages and just before. And the Turks, although in the 20th century their power was largely eclipsed, there remained among the Turkish people not only a strong longing on the parts of certain people for empire, but also because many, many ethnic Turks lie outside of modern Turkey, there was a strong nationalist movement among the so-called outside Turks, people of Turkish extraction who live outside the borders of modern Turkey. Now, this pan-Turkist movement has been very, very strong in the 20th century, and because many of the Turk-ik-speaking peoples lie inside the boundaries of the modern Soviet Union, pan-Turkism took a largely anti-Soviet character in its attempt to unite all Turkic-speaking peoples under into one national entity. The pan-Turkist movement has sought the return of many of the Turkic-speaking areas of the Soviet Union as part of a greater Turkey. And this pan-Turkist movement is one of the things that we're going to be looking at, and its incorporation into the ABM. This will be cropping up later in future broadcasts, in particular in the background of the shooting of the Pope. We're not going to look at that specifically this evening, but we are going to look at the pan-Turkist movement as part of German fascism and even before, and we're going to see how that became incorporated into the ABN. Now, recalling again, fascist Poland under Marshal Pilsudski and its aspirations to regain part of the Soviet Union, one of the things that Marshal Pilsudski set up was something called the Prometheus Organization, okay, the name for the Greek god who brought fire to man, supposedly, the Greek Titan, I should say, and the Prometheus Organization was basically, as the researcher, by the way, credit for all of the information on the pan-Turkist movement here, including the Prometheus Organization, goes to a fabulous researcher in the East. And when these people were actually two researchers, and when they were explaining this to me, they characterized the Prometheus movement as sort of a pre-wackle-wackle, at least with regard to its European and Eurasian components. It basically was just that. It was sort of an anti-Soviet group which was composed largely of various nationalist groups inside the Soviet Union and sought to break up the Soviet Union and defeat the Soviet government in that way. It was not only anti-Soviet, but anti-communist and explicitly fascist in its outlook, although many of the people involved with it were nationalists, and the anti-communism and fascism were secondary, if they were of any importance at all to them. However, the organization itself, as we're going to see, began cooperating with the Third Reich, which made good use of pan-Turkist elements. Following information about the Prometheus Network, this pre-wackle-wackle based in Pilsudski's Poland, which involved pan-Turkist elements to a considerable extent, information on this comes from a book called Pan-Turkism in Turkey, subtitled A Study of Irredentism, was authored by Jacob Landau, L-A-N-D-A-U, published in London by C. Hurst & Company. I don't know the date offhand. And Landau writes of the Prometheus Network as follows. Speaking of the period just before World War II, during this period, several periodicals of pan-Turk character were published in Europe. Most were issued regularly, probably because of the expenses involved, but there were two exceptions. Turan Mekumasi, published in Budapest, and Prometheus, an anti-Soviet journal originating in Poland. And of Prometheus, skipping down, Landau writes, and talking here about something which we needn't concern ourselves with, which is pan-Turanic journals here and so forth. It was evident that it's not important to pay attention to that, but leading into discussion of the Prometheus Network, it was evident that the Turan Society and its publications constituted an expression of the isolation felt by the Hungarians in what appeared to them as a hostile environment, as well as a manifestation of their search for potential allies. To a great extent, this was also the feeling of those Polish circles which published the other long-term interwar periodical, Prometei. This was the organ of the Promethean League, a semi-clandestine, anti-Soviet association established and sponsored by President Pilsudski, the Polish Ministry for Foreign Affairs, and the General Staff as an umbrella organization to provide financial assistance and political coordination for anti-communist governments in exile. All those who had suffered at the hands of the Soviets were considered as their natural allies against the Soviet peril. Among these, the outside Turks held a prominent position. The association's bulletin, Prometei, Organe de Défense des Nationales des Peuples du Caucase et de l'Ukraine, was published monthly in Paris from November of 1926 to April of 1938. Note here that in addition to the outside Turks, Ukrainian nationalists were very prominent in Prometheus. Continuing, Turkestan was subsequently added to its masthead, and the publication was ultimately named Prometei, Organe de Défense des Nationales des Peuples of the USSR. Well-known pan-Turkists such as Wezul Zad, Mirza Bala, and others contributed articles about the strong sentiments for independence and for a pan-Turk union in Azerbaijan, the Caucasus, and Turkestan. Polish financial aid to pan-Turkist organizations may well have continued even during the Second World War. This subject, however, lies beyond the scope of our immediate concern. What does not lie outside of the scope of our immediate concern, though, is that the anti-Soviet aspirations of the pan-Turkists and other elements, the Ukrainians of the Promethean League, were to find expression in the Third Reich.
Now, this next section is from a book called Turkism and the Soviets, and the book is by Charles Warren Hostler, Colonel, U.S. Air Force, and it's published 1957 by George Allen and Unwin Limited of London.
It's also worth noting that some of the people who helped, this guy was an Air Force colonel who did a lot of research on this stuff, and there's an interesting note there.
And as we get into this, the segment we're reading itself, you'll notice a kind of a slightly interesting tone to some of the comments the man makes about these Turkish connections to the Third Reich. And one of the things, you may remember a name from the first article that we read, he talks about Hostler in his foreword, mentions, how does he put it? Okay, here, returning from Turkey in 1950, I was assigned to the U.S. Air Force's Farsighted Graduate Training Program at Georgetown University. Okay. In this period, I had the good fortune to become associated with Dr. Stefan T. Passani, who guided me in writing a shorter study, The Pan-Turanian Appeal, et cetera, et cetera. And he thanks Passani again at the end. Now, Passani, again, is a figure of the far right affiliated with WACL, as we mentioned in the first article.
And a member of the WACCFL steering committee that we just looked at with Messrs. Kramer and Guyland.
And a bigwig at our own local Hoover Institution, as well as his affiliation with Georgetown. Georgetown, of course, we've talked about a great deal because of its involvement in a whole variety of right-wing politics, and it's basically, among other things, it's a journalist factory for the right wing, and we've talked about Claire Sterling, Michael Ledeen, Arno de Borgrav, etc., etc. Claire Sterling, Michael Ledeen, again, particularly interesting because of the fact that, as Dave mentioned, the pan-Turkish movement comes in very strongly into the assassination attempt on the Pope, and here we have this other connection to Georgetown, to Passani, and things like that, of people writing about these same groups also, and also being affiliated with the World Anti-Communist League. So that's something we'll probably get into at a later point. Anyway, I'm going to read a little bit from Turkism and the Soviets by Charles Warren Hostler, USAF and Georgetown graduate. The pan-Turkist irredentists regarded as inevitable the defeat of the USSR and considered possible the creation of a confederation of all the Turkish peoples of Soviet Russia and Chinese Turkestan under the Turkish Republic's leadership. In general, Soviet sources are in accord with the Western ones on this question. And Miller, in his Ocherki Noveshi Histori Turci, begins the story of German-Turkish collaboration with a period preceding the outbreak of the German-Soviet War. Four days prior to the German attack on the Soviets on July 18, 1941, the Turkish-German Pact of Friendship and Non-Aggression was signed. In the interval from 1941 to 1942, the Turkish press openly assailed the Soviets. There were indications of increased Turkish preparation to take part in events and to arrange Caucasian and other Turkish areas independently or with German concurrence. In the autumn of 1942, The Turks concentrated troops at the Caucasian border, anticipating the fall of Stalingrad. The anti-Soviet campaign of the Turkish press had then reached its zenith. One may conclude that highly placed persons in the Turkish state had plans ready to exploit all the possibilities the German-Soviet war and a collapse of the USSR could furnish for the realization of pan-Turkish ideals. The outbreak of the war in June 1941 aroused great hopes among the Turco-Tatar leaders scattered in the West and in Turkey. Nearly all of these leaders approached the Germans and supplied them with various aid memoirs, documents, etc. The Germans also sought contacts and the exchange of opinions. Veli Kajum Khan, one of the chief followers of Mustafa Chokai, also Kokayo or Chokayev, a leader of the Turkestanis, we'll just call him Mustafa Chokai, a leader of the Turkestanis, was in touch with the Germans and had given them pertinent facts on Turkestan. He insisted that Turkestan should not become part of any future Russian Federation. Mehmet Emin Rezulzadeh, the head of the Azerbaijan Musavat Party, went to Bucharest after the occupation of Poland in 1939. He sent an exhaustive report to the Germans and subsequently went to Berlin. The Promethean leaders, who were living in Warsaw during the German occupation, also supplied the Germans with material.
Noting there a continuation of anti-Soviet policy from the Promethean organization originally under Polish sponsorship, a continuity of action to the Third Reich.
Ayas Ishaki and Syed Shamil, leaders of the Kazan Tatars and North Caucasians respectively, also went to Berlin. The Crimean Turks were represented in Berlin by Mustagib Fazil and Edige Kiremal, mentioned above in the letter from General, well, we don't care about that, and several Turkish politicians and unofficial representatives, including ex-General Erkilet, traveled there, several Turkish politicians and unofficial representatives, including ex-General Erkilet, traveled there or visited the front lines. Edige Kiremal and other Turco-Tatar leaders were permitted by the Germans to visit the occupied portions of the Turco-Tatar regions of the Soviet Union, namely Crimea and the Northern Caucasus. A most important political and military aspect of World War II pan-Turkist activity involved the national military units formed of Turks from the Soviet Union, who fought in the German armed forces against the Soviets. The idea of forming these units originated with two prominent Turks, Mustafa Chokai and Veli Kajum Khan. Mustafa Chokai died in December 1941, but German-educated Kajum Khan became commissioner for Turkestan, together with the other commissioners for Azerbaijan, Volga, Ural, Caucasus, and Crimea, who were appointed by the German Ostministerium, Ministry for Occupied Eastern Territories. The idea of using the Turks of the USSR in the fight against the Soviets must have been readily accepted by the German high command, whose approach to such problems were purely utilitarian. There was probably no serious Nazi political opposition to this idea, as the territories inhabited by the Turks of the USSR lay in general outside the limits of planned direct expansion of the Reich.
I would interrupt that this is wishful thinking on his part. In fact, one of the key people that we're going to look at, Theodor Oberland, this is sort of an aside, who was actually imprisoned in a concentration camp for a short time for proposing the use of these various Turkic nationalities as allies of the Third Reich. After a while, the German losses forced a reconsideration of that position, but initially they were pure Aryans, and so they were actually scornful. Although they would use them, they would not grant them equal ally status, and so that's actually sort of not an accurate statement on his part here.
The Germans needed military security and combat replacements. The receptiveness of the Turkish prisoners of war to the proposal stemmed in part from their political and religious convictions. The Wehrmacht was aware of their propaganda influence on other Soviet troops of Turk background, and also of their political potential of diminishing enemy resistance, achieving speedy pacification of occupied territory, and making allies out of these populations. The overwhelming majority of the Turk volunteers were recruited from among Soviet prisoners of war captured by the Germans. The 162nd Infantry Division, commanded by General Oskar von Niedermayer, a well-known German specialist in Middle Eastern affairs, was assigned the task of organizing them into combat battalions. This activity was implemented by Army Group South, which was largely in the central Ukraine area. A top secret memoir by Rosenberg, that's Albert Rosenberg, concerning his discussion with Hitler on December 14, 1941, indicates by that date, partial Turkization of these units was completed, and the experience was judged successful. On December 30th, 1941, the High Command of the Wehrmacht was directed to establish a Turkestan Legion consisting of members of the following nationalities: Turkmens, Uzbeks, Kazakhs, Kyrgyzs, Karakalpaks, and Tajiks. B, Caucasian Mohammedan Legion, composed of Azerbaijanis, Dagestanis, Ingushes, Lezhins, and Chechens. C, a Georgian Legion. And D, an Armenian Legion.
By the way, Armenia is one of these territories which has sort of got bisected during the imperial period. Half of it's in Russia, half of it's in Turkey. Like Azerbaijan, another area in the Soviet Union, is half in Soviet and half in Iran.